I'm Steve Potter, and this is Cityscape. Coming up a little later, quilter Susan Marth will discuss her work. For more than two decades, British artist Jeremy Deller has challenged the idea of traditional art. His exhibitions have included a replica of a cafe designed as a parade float and a 1980s battle in the UK involving striking miners. A few years ago, he received an award for, quote, creating art that encourages public responses and creativity. A selection of Deller's work, called Jeremy Deller, Joy in People, is now on view at the Contemporary Art Museum. St. Louis Public Radio's Aaron Williams talked with Deller and asked him about his first exhibition.
My parents went on holiday, and I decided to do an exhibition in the house in their absence, and it started in the bedroom, and it went throughout the whole house in the end.
That's amazing.
They would not have thought that. Luckily, they didn't find out for some years. It wasn't sort of full of people, but I didn't want it to be full of people. I was terrified that someone would like put a cigarette end out on a table or a carpet or something. So I kept it by invitation. Some nice people came, but I never wanted a full house of people going crazy.
Well, what kind? Tell us about the type of art that you chose to exhibit. It was a collection of T-shirts, and then there were some portraits. And
there was T-shirts. There's some paintings. I don't really paint, but this is about the only time I've shown paintings about the life of Keith Moon, who was the drummer with The Who, this British band in the 60s and 70s. And in the bathroom, or toilet, as we call it, I made a little booklet of graffiti from the men's toilets at the British Library.
Wow.
So this is graffiti that's very academic and intellectual, even competitively academic and intellectual, but also quite pornographic. So it's a very interesting mixture of academics trying to outdo each other, having conversations and arguments with each other, doing word games and wordplay with each other. It's just very funny, actually, and it shows that sort of frustration you get in libraries. Just to sit in the library toilets and read this stuff, it was amazing. It was like an education.
Gosh. Would you ever do that again?
Do what again?
Have a private, extremely private exhibition like that in your home?
Yeah, I would do it if it felt right, if I needed to. Obviously, in terms of where I am as an artist, it's not necessary now to do it, but it's the kind of thing I could happily do.
Did you know what type of artist you wanted to be?
No, I had no idea really what was going to happen. I knew I was pretty useless, but I was good at certain things, but I still couldn't put my finger on it.
It seems like things, the wheels started to turn around 1986, and that was when you were acquainted with or became introduced to one of the great pop culture artists, arguably, of all time, Andy Warhol.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, this is before I started making work, but that was sort of a pivotal moment. I was 20, and he was in London, and he had an opening, and I went to the opening, and he signed some things for me. There's lots of people there, as you can imagine. And then I met one of his entourage, and this guy said, I'll come to the hotel in a couple of days. So I went. I took a friend because I didn't really know what to expect behind the door. But it was all pretty innocent.
Okay.
And it was fun. And they said, I'll come to New York this summer. Come to the factory and just hang out. We're doing some video thing with MTV. We might need help. And I thought, well, most of the time when people invite you to do things, especially in Britain, they actually don't want you to do it. And they're hoping you won't say yes.
They just kind of say it to be nice.
Exactly. It's out of politeness. But I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to do this. Even if you don't want me to, I'm just going to show up. And I did. And so I was there for a week, 2 weeks in 1986, just hanging out there, really. And that was pretty amazing. That's an education in itself.
Did you get a chance to talk with him one-on-one? Did you just kind of tell him things that you were thinking and ideas that you had?
No, I didn't really tell him ideas. I mean, he just liked gossip and information.
Yeah.
He just wanted to know what I'd been up to, who I'd seen, where I'd been, what I liked, what I didn't like, what the royal family were like. And he just wanted information.
Because you were the pipeline to Queen Elizabeth, naturally.
Well, maybe he felt that. But I was definitely an English boy, and he wanted to know what was going on. I think he just wanted to know all the time what was happening.
He died the next year in 1987.
He did, yes.
Did you feel like you had to carry on a torch in some type of way?
Not really, because he was unique and no one could really achieve what he'd achieved. But he was for me, a great role model of what an artist could be and what an artist can be. It can basically be whatever they want to be, and he was. He did whatever he created this world for himself. And it's a world that we now live in.
Exactly.
You know, he changed the world.
And And then you kind of came up during this this young British art movement, which when you think about it was kind of like the brat pack of,
yes.
Of the art industry.
They were brats, some of them. I knew those people. I still know some of them. And I was around it, but I was never part of that gang.
Tell us a little bit about what you were doing during
that
time.
Well, I was doing events. I was doing little things, little performances, little interventions, you'd call them. Whereas they were making big art that went in galleries and museums and was sold and bought. I mean, it's very traditional, really, a lot of it. But my work was unsaleable in more ways than one, and you couldn't really buy it, or sometimes you couldn't even see it. It just existed as an idea. So it was very different. It was intangible in the way that their work, a lot of their work, was very tangible and object-based.
So it seemed like at the time your work was very personal. Were right. you hoping for recognition, though?
You're always hoping for something, but you hope that people are going to see it. But you just don't know, really. You're just stumbling around. Well, I was just stumbling around, going from one thing to the next and just seeing how it went. You're not really thinking of a career as such. Recognition would have been nice, and I got a little bit. It sort of grows. Overnight success, you know, is like a 7-year process, mm-hmm. really.
As time went on, it seems like a lot of your work took on a much more political front. There were a couple of different video, I guess you call it, you can say, I could call them an installation. I mean, there were videos, but at the same time, you yeah. could say video installation in a way. There was one that caught my attention that you did called The Battle of Orgreave,
yes.
Yes. Tell us about that one.
Well, that was, there was a very bitter strike in the 80s with the miners against the government at the time, which is a conservative government, which Margaret Thatcher was the leader of. And the strike went on for a year. And in the middle of the strike, almost the midpoint, there was a huge confrontation between striking miners and the police. You know, over 10,000 people were involved in this. And I remember seeing it on TV, and I wanted to reconstruct it with members of a reenactment societies, but also with former miners in the place where it had originally happened. So we didn't have 10,000, we had about 900, and we did a public performance, which we then made into a film. And at CAM, yeah, there's the film, but there's also a room of research and information about the strike. So if you don't really know about the strike, you can find out a little bit beforehand.
That was a very violent time to want to recreate, though. Were
yeah.
you, did you feel like that part of the story hadn't been told, or that?
Well, yes, it was because it was a strike, but it turned more into like a civil war, effectively, without guns. The battles were huge; they were massive. They looked like something from a medieval battle, and the miners had a very, very rough time with the media. The media were very supportive of Margaret Thatcher. The media, most of which, you know, in terms of newspapers, was owned by Rupert Murdoch. So in a way, not much changes. And so they got a very rough time. And even 17 years later, when I did the reenactment, a lot of them were still very suspicious of me suspicious of the media still, because it really hurt them the way they were treated. And they wanted to rewrite history, really, in their eyes.
Is that what made them want to trust you? Because that, you know, that takes a lot.
Yes, and I think, well, basically I just said to them, look, I'm going to tell it from your perspective. I'm not interested in what's gone before.
Okay.
We need to look at this again.
And then after that, you took a bit of a pilgrimage to America.
I did. I left Britain because I thought I'd got to get out of this country, because I've done this project, which is all about Britain and British history. It's very contentious. And I thought there might be some terrible backlash. So I went to Oakland for a year and spent 2001, 2002 in Oakland.
And you came to Oakland right before September 11th.
I did. I arrived on the 9th. And I was in America for a year. When I was there, I made a book about like a tour of California around people as opposed to places. So the Black Panther movement started in Oakland. So it starts in Oakland with the Black Panthers, and then it goes around to the Gold Country and the desert and so on. So it was a tour of people as opposed to towns or cities.
Well, you know, that gives a different perspective. You know, there's one thing examining tourism, but, you know, it's quite another to examine the people who are actually affected by the things that are going on.
Yeah, and also people are history, aren't they? And so these people I interviewed, a lot of them had incredibly interesting lives and take part in recent historical events, which might have been, for example, the Bay of Pigs invasion, or the Black Power struggle in the 60s and the late 60s, or the early days of Las Vegas. So, I mean, people, and Americans always want to tell you their story. That's the difference between them and British people. One of the differences is that they're more than happy to talk about their lives to you.
We love to open up.
Yeah, and that's good.
And then after you left California, you took a turn to Texas for a little while, didn't you?
I was in Texas for 10 weeks. I was in San Antonio, and I made a film there about Texas.
Called Memory Bucket.
Memory Bucket, which was a shop I saw that sold bits and bobs for scrapbooks, like things you just stick in scrapbooks and make collage and stuff. I just thought that's an amazing use of English, or abuse of English, whatever way you want to look at it. And so it's a film about Texas in 2003. So that was not a great time, really, in terms of because of the war in Iraq, and it was a very divided, seemed to be quite a divided place. But the end of the film, it ends, there's like a false end with Willie Nelson. I filmed Willie Nelson at a concert. I mean, that ends, and then I actually also filmed at a cave where bats emerged every evening at dusk, and it ends with like 5 million bats leaving a cave.
Having a British eye towards American culture and politics, what was it that you personally wanted to bring out in your work that you wanted other people to see?
So that's a very good question. I was just interested in the history and historical resonances and comparisons. So in Texas, for example, I went to Waco, the site of the Branch Davidian siege. And also the Alamo is in San Antonio, which is another siege, which is like glorious defeat, really, but mm-hmm. a glorious siege. And for the Branch Davidians was like quite the opposite. So it's just how history repeats itself, or there are patterns as I saw them. And so I was just interested in examining that as an outsider. Just wandering around, really. But in a car, so you don't really wander in a car, but just driving about.
In the
Southwest. Yeah. You're just seeing what stuck, really.
There is one more piece of art that I want to touch on that is the most, I guess you call it imposing, within the exhibit. It was a piece that you created for the Manchester International Festival in 2009, and they asked you to create art, and you thought, you know what, I'm going to go completely as big as possible. At least that's how I took it, that you just said, I'm going to go huge. And you created a parade.
I made a parade. Well, I put together a procession. I call it procession, but a parade is the same thing, and through the streets, because I wanted to show the town to itself. I wanted people from Manchester to look at other people from Manchester and look at this sort of portrait of the town in terms of a procession. One of the parts of the procession was called the Unrepentant Smokers, and it was a group of people smoking, walking down the street. Someone in the council was absolutely horrified by this. He was this anti-smoking Taliban guy. I mean, he wasn't a member of the Taliban, obviously, but by which I mean he was rabid anti-smoker. He'd been a smoker, and he'd just gone the other way. And he tried to prevent it all happening and, you know, all this kind of nonsense. But actually, it taught me a lot about publicity and local politics. He got him a lot of publicity, but also got my procession, my parade, a lot of publicity, and it really helped it. But that was one problem. But it was really about the social life of the town. So there's a lot of young people in it, young people who are seen as antisocial. These goth and emo kids were one of them. And people that sort of do their cars and make their cars really nice and then drive around really fast, they were in it. So it's all different kinds of people who were taking part. And it was really great to sort of make that. And so one of the elements was a cafeteria from a market, which we reconstructed and remade.
Called Valerie.
Valerie's Cafe, and which is now in Contemporary Art Museum St. Louis, and every day serving tea. So you can go and sit in this cafe and have a cup of tea after you've seen a bit of the show.
But it doesn't move, unfortunately.
Well, fortunately, I would say, doesn't it? You don't want it moving in there.
Because in the parade, I believe people were actually, you know,
they're on the back, yes, it was moving through the streets, and they were there having cups of tea. It's meant to be a kind of surrealistic moment.
That's British contemporary artist Jeremy Deller talking with St. Louis Public Radio's Aaron Williams. A selection of Deller's work, called Jeremy Deller, Joy in People, is on display at Contemporary Art Museum in Grand Center now through April 28th. To see photos of Deller's work, visit the Cityscape page of our website, stlpublicradio.org. Coming up next, the art of quilting. This is St. Louis Public Radio.